When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
What is... Dax, are you...
tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Your old or broken phone can let you down. But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence with a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. After all, you don't want your old phone to die on you when you're lost.
Perfect.
Or for your broken phone to glitch at the worst possible time.
Hey, can I get your number? Oh.
Trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, February 4th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the documentaries of Sundance 2025. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And Slash Film editor and chief film critic Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, guys. So Sundance is over now. All three of us watched a bunch of movies. We're going to talk about them over the course of the next couple days. I thought it would be cool to kick off by just talking about a lot of the documentaries that we saw. And Chris had an idea to frame this conversation, at least the first half of it, around a trilogy of true crime movies that came out that they don't have anything to do with each other, but they are sort of about the true crime genre in one way or another. So let's start by talking about Zodiac Killer Project. This is one that all three of us saw. Charlie Shackleton directed this. It's one of the most unconventional true crime documentaries I think I've ever seen. The story is that he wanted to adapt the memoir of a cop who worked on the Zodiac Killer case. And this book that this guy wrote alleged that the cop and his team figured out the killer's true identity, but were the subject of a shadowy cover-up that forced them to drop the case. So this director gets the rights, and he starts pre-production on this movie, but somehow the whole thing falls apart at the last minute, just before production starts. So instead of just scrapping the idea, Charlie Shackleton decided to make a documentary about what that adaptation would have been like if everything had gone according to plan. So I ended up enjoying this movie quite a bit, even though it's pretty unconventional. But Chris, what did you make of this one? Do you like this movie overall?
Yeah, you know, of the three I watched, of the three we're going to talk about right now, this is the one I like the least, but I appreciate what it's trying to do. It does a very good job of sort of pointing out like the formulas that so many true crime documentaries follow, especially like stuff on Netflix. They all follow this sort of like almost like rigid sort of formula where they're all doing the same thing over and over again. And I appreciated how this highlighted that. The two problems I have with this, one, it's so low energy that I kind of like, felt sleepy watching it. Like I understand like that's sort of like he's doing this on purpose to like, to make it as unsensational as possible, as opposed to like, you know, generic true crime documentaries, which would sensationalize things, but it's so low key that I was like, oh, like, can we liven this up just a little bit? And I also feel like based on what he's saying, the documentary he would have made kind of would have sucked. Like it kind of would have been just as bad as the movie he's sort of like taking the piss out of. And I don't know if that's like intentional or what, but like the impression I got is that the movie he would have made kind of would have been not very good. So I don't know. Like I appreciate what he's trying to do here, but like I said, I like this the least of the three, or it had like the least impact on me of the three.
What'd you think, Brad?
Yeah, no, I actually really like this one because of like how it calls attention to all the tropes that we see in true crime documentaries. And like I appreciated kind of the quiet, low energy of it. Like it, there was a dryness that made it feel like it was, you know, maybe more satirical than even he intended. I do agree with Chris though, that if he were to have made the movie that he originally envisioned, it would have felt just like any other true crime documentary, you know, just about one of the more famous killers. And it's probably better that whether it's, this was something that he actually planned to do and is kind of just playing up the fact that they decided to do this instead because of the rights issue with the book in question that they weren't able to adapt for their movie, or if this is like the result of like, well, let's just make a movie where we don't have to do what we were going to do originally, but we can also still talk about it and then also kind of poke fun at the genre a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciated that. And there's a lot of really like amusing moments that I wasn't expecting here. Like there's one where he's using this like establishing shot of a small town as he's like panning across this intersection, and he goes, oh wait, check this out, this is really cool. And like this guy does like a wheelie on like a scooter in the footage that they captured. He's like, that was awesome.
yeah most of the movie is comprised of these wide establishing shots of locations that he was going to use in that initial project, and then the whole thing is narrated to kind of fill in the details of the story. And then like he talks about what kind of recreations that he would have used and stuff like that. And there's a lot of these side-by-side clips of shows like The Jinx and Making a Murderer and that Jeffrey Dahmer Netflix show to poke fun, as you guys were saying, at the rigid formulaic presentation of a lot of these stories. I found it to be, I totally understand what Chris is saying about it being like kind of low energy, but I think there's something mesmerizing about that. Like the simplicity of the shots and the recreations here, there's just this really tense scene of a fishbowl that is arguably just as effective in this form, and that is basically just like narration and a few insert shots, as it would have been in a fully mounted adaptation of the material. So I think there's something about the simplicity of the way that this story is being told that, I don't know, it still pulled me in. So I thought it was interesting. I hope it gets distribution at some point, because I would love for people to be able to see this. I mean, I guess we could say that about most of the things we're going to be talking about today. So the next one is called The Perfect Neighbor. And Brad, why don't you tell me what this movie is?
So Perfect Neighbor is a documentary that mostly unfolds with body cam footage from police officers. It unfolds down in Florida, and it follows the story of this small neighborhood where there is this woman living there who is just kind of a tyrant, really mean, constantly pestering the kids who are playing in property in this, like, it's basically a complex of rental houses. And whenever the kids are playing in property nearby that isn't actually her property, she's constantly yelling at them and is nuisance. She's basically like the ultimate Karen. She's constantly calling the police. And it's so many times that like most of the footage is just from the body cams of the cops coming to the neighborhood, talking to this woman whose name is Susan, because of course it is. And the documentary lets the footage speak for itself. There's no narration. There are some voiceovers from interviews that police did with people in the neighborhood based on what happens in the movie. And is, I don't know if it's the kind of thing where it was a pretty publicized event. So should I just talk about what is, I guess, the spoiler element of the movie, or?
Man, I don't know. Chris, what do you think about that?
I feel like we should, because it's kind of like,
it's kind of the crux of, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be weird to avoid it. And it is like a real thing. It's not like this is like.
So what's unfortunate about this story is that it eventually resulted in this woman, Susan, shooting and killing a mother in their neighborhood, a black woman, and in an incident where she shot through the door and the woman ended up dying from the gunshot wound. And it's such a infuriating, harrowing, dramatic, powerful experience. And what I loved so much about it was, again, how the filmmaker just let captured footage and security cameras and footage of police interrogation and all this stuff speak for itself. You know, it's obviously it's edited and it's framed in such a way that, you know, tells the story, but like, it's very clear what happened here and like what is going on. And man, yeah, this was tough to watch. It was quite an emotional experience to see all of this happening.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's kind of about, it becomes about Florida's stand your ground laws.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily like a movie that hits you over the head with a bunch of like political messaging or like tries to encourage you to go out and vote or whatever. It just sort of presents this story almost without commentary. The director, I think their name is Geeta Ganbahir, basically, as you said, just sort of presents the footage as is and like leaves you to draw your own conclusions about how stupid and terrible these laws are that are in this godforsaken state that I live in. So, Chris, what did you make of The Perfect Neighbor?
Yeah, this was really good. Yeah, pretty much I agree with everything Brad said and you said. I have to compliment the editing of this film is just fantastic because it's like invisible editing in a way. Like obviously the film is edited, but it's not done. It's done in this very sort of seamless way of cutting this footage together to make a narrative. I would love to learn more about like how many hours of footage they had to like piece this together. And just the story is just, it's just heartbreaking and it's engrossing and it's just fascinating to watch this sort of unfold the way it does. And a lot of stuff here like caught me by surprise. Like, you know, I have no love for the police, but I was really taken aback at how understanding the cops were in this situation, because like you would think like white cops in Florida being called on black kids, you would think like these cops are going to immediately like take the side of the white woman. But the woman calling the cops on these kids is so clearly in the wrong here. Like all the cops are like, we sympathize with you kids. We understand what's going on here. You know, we have to come out because it's our job. At the same time, I don't think the film is like pro police or anything like that. It's very like straightforward. But I just found that fascinating how like even the cops in this situation were like, we completely get that this woman is, a nut for lack of a better term. And like, it's fascinating because like, I can almost sympathize in a way. Like I have like, I don't want to get too off in the weeds here, but like, I have kids who live on my block who are very loud and annoying. And it's like, I sympathize with being like, oh, I'm annoyed at these kids on my street. But like, I would never call the cops on them. That's such like a baffling, like, kids are on my street being loud, I'm going to call the cops on them. Like, I don't understand how like people have that thought process where it's like, mm-hmm. to jump to that, like, to be like, it's one thing to be annoyed by kids on your street. It's another to be like, I'm going to call the cops on you. Like, that's so like I just can't fathom that mindset. And like the way the movie just presented it as the, you know, this woman who's like clearly just unstable, not that it excuses her actions, but she's also clearly like racist. There's a scene like near the end where she's being interrogated by police and she was like, oh, when I was growing up, the N-word just meant a dirty person. It wasn't racist. It's like, come on, lady. Like, no, yeah. No, like that is such like a bullshit like thing to say. And it's just like, oh man, I don't know. This really got to me. Like after the shooting happens, they show the cops showing up and like the news spreading through the neighborhood and everyone finding out. And like that really like hit me on like this like emotional level. I was not like expecting. It was just like very raw. It's a very raw movie in general. And I just found this very like Brad said, it's hard to watch, but it's a really well put together film.
Yeah, it's a raw movie because they use raw footage, and then it's also emotionally raw because especially that scene you're mentioning where like the woman's ex-husband finds out and is just obviously like, this is the worst moment in these people's lives being captured on film. And there's something like perversely compelling about that, but it's also just like your heart goes out to them in such a huge way. Like the kids are like 10 and 11 years old, you know, and they find out that their mom is just not coming back. And it's just like all because this woman across the street who was just like the worst type of snitch imaginable, this joyless buzzkill, is just has no understanding or empathy or like grace for the way that other people live their lives. It's like, yeah, somebody said the word infuriating earlier, and that's, I think, the perfect word to describe this movie. But yeah, I don't know, Brad, if you have any other thoughts about this one before we move on.
No, I think it's definitely a must-see documentary, though. I mean, it's as hard as it is to watch. It's one of those things where, like, it really, you know, makes you understand, you know, just like the absolute, like, you know, unreasonable hate that there is out there from people, and just the lengths to which people will go to, like, make people unhappy for no good reason whatsoever.
Yeah. Okay, so the last one that we wanted to talk about in this sort of crime triptych that we have here is called Predators. And Chris, why don't you tell me what this movie is?
Yeah, so this, I would honestly say this is probably the best thing I saw at Sundance this year. It's probably like one of my, I don't want to say, it seems weird to say favorite because it's such like a touchy subject matter, but it's like one of the best documentaries I've seen in a long time. You know, on the surface, this is a documentary about To Catch a Predator, which is a very popular news sort of program where Chris Hansen was this guy. He was the host of the show. And they would use decoys posing as minors to lure pedophiles to like come to houses. And these people would come in the house thinking they were there to have sex with minors. And then Chris Hansen would come out and he'd be like, "What are you doing here?" And it would become this whole thing. And it became a very popular show. It actually ran not very long. The original incarnation did not run very long, which I didn't realize until I watched this. I thought it was on longer than it. I think they said it only ran for like 2 years, which I honestly thought it was on longer because it had such a huge impact on like pop culture. Like it was like they even show in the documentary how it became like parodied everywhere on like 30 Rock and Conan O'Brien. And like just people would like it became sort of like this punchline. And like, you know, on the surface, it's about To Catch Predator, but it's not really about that. It's more about how we as a society consume this sort of thing. I watch a lot of true crime. I'm not ashamed to say I enjoy the true crime genre, but this documentary is very much asking questions that are like, what does it mean to enjoy true crime? Like, because when you strip everything away, true crime is really just turning pain and suffering into a form of entertainment. And you can defend it any way you want, and you can dress it up, and you can be like, "Oh, it's about the justice." And this documentary makes a really good point about like, it's not like you can say that all you want, but that's not really what's going on here. The documentary points out that like, you know, Chris Hansen and the crew of To Catch a Predator, they're not cops. They're not law enforcement agencies. Like they work with cops but they're not cops. So like if they're getting a confession from someone who comes in and confesses to being a pedophile, you can't like use that in court. Like these people are not being given their Miranda rights. They're just like confessing to a camera crew. And the movie points out that like most of these cases are not like prosecutable. Like you can't like do anything with them. So what does like justice really even mean? Like, is it the legal system? Is it ruining someone's life? And I don't know, this is such a, when I was watching this, I was so like engrossed in it. And I was also kept thinking like, I don't understand. I don't know how this is going to play with a wide audience because, and I've already seen people on like Letterboxd reviews and a few people like on YouTube commenting on interviews with the director being like, "This movie's defending pedophiles." And like, I really don't think that's what this movie is doing. There is an unusual amount of empathy at play in this documentary, especially because the director points out that he was sexually abused as a child. And that's sort of why he wanted to make this movie. And, you know, but I don't think this movie is like being like, we should defend pedophiles. I think it's more asking us why we enjoy watching people be destroyed, basically, for lack of a better phrase. Like, this is really just about how these people's lives are being dismantled for entertainment purposes. And, you know, you can look at it a certain way. You can be like, these people deserve to have their lives destroyed. They're the worst of the worst. But I don't know, like, what does it mean to like laugh about this? Like I said, like this became like fodder for comedy. like, I just don't know, like, I don't know, this documentary asks a lot of difficult questions and it doesn't really answer them. And I suppose you could say like that's a cop out, but I kind of appreciated that it just sort of like leaves the questions unanswered. You have to sit with them. You have to sort of sit with them. At the same time, I do think the documentary does a good job of pointing out that Chris Hansen is just like kind of a piece of shit, like just like a just like a real kind of like scumbag who like to likes to pretend he's a cop, basically. Like he's, you know, and I don't want to give away too much but like the final scene of this sort of like hit me like a ton of bricks. The way, like, the end of the movie, Chris Hansen finally sits down to talk with the filmmaker, and I won't say how that plays out, but the way it plays out is really just unsettling. This is a very disturbing documentary. Like, beyond To Catch Predator, there's this whole section where they point out that like it's inspired leagues of like copycat to have like YouTube shows, which is like a million times worse, because like even like the best thing you could say about To Catch Predator is like it was working with law enforcement, but you have people on YouTube who are just like literally just cosplaying, like there's this guy called like Skeet Hansen who is just like, oh my God, like this guy is just bad, like just bad news, man. And again, like, I don't want to make it sound like I'm defending pedophiles. Please don't come at me, because I'm not. But it's just like, I don't know, man, like these are really difficult things. And I really appreciated that this documentary was so thoughtful about them without like sensationalizing them and taking a stance. I don't know, this really got to me, this documentary.
Yeah, it wants us to feel humanity for people who've done something horrible, which is like a really uncomfortable thing to ask audiences to do, because it's a complexity that we don't normally engage with as a society. Normally, judgment is passed and we just kind of brush our hands together and walk away and never think about it again. And this documentary is turning the camera back on us in a way and saying, hey, let's, you know, this is a little bit more complicated than the show may have portrayed, you know, back in the day. Brad, what did you think about this one?
Yeah, no, I mean, Chris said a lot of, you know, what I was thinking, what I felt while watching it. And, you know, it's one of those things too, where like the whole, it feels strange at first because, you know, you're watching this and like, of course, like these are people who you think are heinous and evil because they were interested in trying to have sex with minors. And then like, it's not that you're supposed to feel sorry for them or feel empathy for them, but the whole idea of like capturing people like that and punishing them and sending them to jail for any crime, really, is supposed to be rehabilitation. And nobody doing any of the shows seems to have any interest in actually doing that. All they're interested in is putting on a show for an audience, giving them something to entertain them, and pat themselves on the back for like, well, we're getting criminals and bad people off the streets. And it's like, yeah, but are you really doing anything to figure out why these people are the way they are? Try and figure out what is in the mindset of these people that compels them to do these things, especially when you see the raw footage that was captured by NBC in police interrogation rooms, things afterwards, where they're not just apologizing because they're in front of a camera that they know is going to be on TV. They're sitting talking with cops and they're expressing legitimate remorse for what they've done, saying that they don't know why they do what they do, asking for help, like they know that they need help. And it can be tough to reconcile like the hate you might have for someone who is trying to do something that is so terrible, but like we should also want to help them so that not only to stop them from maybe having these feelings, but to maybe figure out how to keep other people who have the same problems and haven't tried to act on it in such a way. It's a really complex and like confounding documentary to watch, because like it might change how you feel about how we approach these things. And you know, it's really, really fascinating.
Yeah, very powerful stuff. So that's called Predators, and I'm not sure if it has distribution yet, but I would highly recommend putting this on your radar in case it comes to theaters or a streamer or something like that in the next year or so. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and talk about a bunch more documentaries that we saw at Sundance 2025.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. so you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that.
Yeah.
No hassle.
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
All right, Brad, you and I saw a handful of other docs that I think we can just kind of blaze through relatively quickly. The filmmakers behind Boys State and Girls State, Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss, made a new documentary called Middletown that is about a high school teacher in the 1990s in Middletown, New York, who had a friend who lived near the town dump and was experiencing a bunch of ill effects from it or witnessing shady practices. So this teacher recruits his students into investigating and making a documentary about what's really going on at this dump. It's a pretty cool, inspiring story about finding ways to open kids' minds and like get them interested in things beyond just what's in textbooks. And this investigation that they do ends up uncovering things that they never anticipated, ends up making national news. And a lot of this documentary is footage from the 90s, but it also reunites the students with the teacher in modern day and has them look back on what they did and what happened because of it. So that's called Middletown. I think I'm the only one who saw that one, but it's a really terrific documentary. One of my favorite things that I saw at Sundance. I don't want to give away any of the major details, but there's one thing in here that stuck with me that I think is important for all of us. And it kind of feels timely given the state of the world right now, which is the teacher talks about this idea of civic courage, which he defines as basically acting as if you live in a real democracy, even though we're not in one that actually functions properly. And it may be naive, but I think if enough of us do that, we might be able to keep this thing going for a little while longer. So anyway, that movie is called Middletown. I wouldn't be surprised if Apple picks this up because they have a good relationship with those filmmakers. So keep an eye out for that one. Brad, you saw a movie called Speak. Tell me about this one.
Yes, this is a documentary that follows five different high school kids who are competing in various speech and debate tournaments, all leading up to hopeful competition in a national speech and debate tournament in Phoenix, Arizona. It's pretty standard as far as documentary formula is concerned, follows the kids around in their normal lives and talks to them and their families, watches them as they compete and stuff like that. But for me, this was pretty compelling stuff and a bit nostalgic because I myself competed in speech and debate when I was in high school. So watching this unfold and seeing them in their environment at competitions and practicing in hallways and just all the stuff they talk about and the highs and lows of the competition, like it all felt so familiar and just like home to me. So I experienced so much of this and, you know, it was great to get to know some of these kids and follow along with them and hear what inspired their speeches. What they compete in an event called Original Oratory, which is an event where they write their own speech that is meant to be inspirational, aspirational, kind of explaining a problem that exists and maybe some things to do to fix it. And sometimes citing, you know, events that happened in real life that prove their point and whatnot. And it's these extremely eloquent and articulate, sophisticated kids who feel, you know, wiser beyond their years, but also still occasionally deal with the same problems that every teenager does. But the way that they speak and the way that they write is so profound and powerful that you can't help but get caught up in their speeches. And I really dug this movie a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I watched this as well. First of all, did you participate in that specific type of oratory thing that they do where they develop that type of speech, or were you in a different subset of that?
Yeah, I did other events. So my main event was Congress, which is like they set up a mock Congress and you debate faux resolutions and bills that have been written by other students and chosen by the overall speech organization. And then I also did an event called Impromptu, where there's three different rounds and you get like either a word, a quote, or I want to say it was a person or something like that. And you have like a minute or something to think to yourself before you have to start speaking off the top of your head and compose a speech within that time.
Oh, wow.
And then I did my senior year, they introduced a new event called Original Performance, where you got to write your own, basically like whatever you wanted. It could have been poetry. It could be like a one man show that was drama or humor. It could have been like a duo doing drama or humor, which, cause those are normal events where that you can use written pre-existing copyrighted material to perform. But this was one that you wrote your own. I think I talked about this on the podcast like a long time ago. I wrote a piece called The Wonka Murders that was like a musical parody based on the kids who disappeared in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And this was the trial of Willy Wonka for those kids' murders.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad I asked about that. That's amazing. Yeah, I watched this movie and I didn't really love it because I found it kind of challenging to watch, because the original oratory, the speeches that these kids come up with, they give the same speech at every competition. And this movie follows them over the course of several months, if not a full year. And so all five of these kids are giving the same speech every time. And there might be like a few tweaks here and there, but it's just kind of challenging to sustain interest over an hour and 45 minutes when we hear the same speeches over and over and over again. So,
But I think that they did a good job though of not always repeating the same bits. Like they would repeat certain parts if there was like small adjustments made here and there, something like that. But I thought they did a good job cutting around between different parts of their speech to give you a sense of their whole speech without, you know, showing the same stuff over and over again.
Mm. Okay, so that's called Speak. And then you and I watched a movie called Sugar Babies. And it follows this late teens, early 20s girl named Autumn who lives in the small Louisiana town and makes money as a quote unquote sugar baby, which involves convincing men to pay her for talking to them online. It's not sex work exactly, but it's kind of sex work adjacent maybe. And pretty much the whole movie is tracking Autumn and her friends and family members as she becomes this TikTok influencer, and she teaches other women how to become sugar babies. And it follows Autumn over the course of several years as she tries to move out of this really impoverished small town and grow and evolve as a person and in her relationships. I thought this was a pretty sloppy movie, Brad, but what did you think about this one?
Yeah, I don't know if I would say sloppy, because I feel like the intention was to be, you know, raw with it. You know, the footage is not shot in like a super cinematic way, very much like shooting on the fly. I think for me, perhaps the more frustrating thing was I was anticipating this being a documentary that really dug into like this as like a profession and like I wanting to know more about like how it operates and that kind of thing. But in reality, and honestly, probably intentionally, it's more so meant to be a stealthy push for like people being aware of how the government is fucking people over in many states, but specifically in this one, Louisiana, by not approving a higher minimum wage, which is forcing people like the girls that are focused on in this movie to take on jobs like this and do things that maybe put them in danger or have them doing things that they're not necessarily super keen on doing, but they're doing because it's an easier way to make money than trying to get a legit job that doesn't pay them for what they're actually worth and what their time is worth. So I appreciated them using something that might be interesting for people to want to learn more about, especially because, like, you know, the idea of, you know, an area of a profession that's kind of like sex work adjacent, people are probably like, oh, that's something I don't know much about. But then it's more so about like this sucks and this is why, you know, people are need a higher minimum wage, that kind of thing. So on one level I was frustrated by it, but on another level I appreciated the stealth message as it came about as the movie went on.
Yeah, I think that's what I found kind of sloppy, is those inserts almost, where it kind of feels like they just, you know, it feels like the filmmaker found this TikTok person and decided, hey, I want to make a movie about you. And then just kind of threw in a handful of cutaways to Louisiana politicians trying and failing to raise the minimum wage. And like, it kind of made it seem like the director was trying to make the story feel bigger than it actually is. Like, obviously, a raised minimum wage would be helpful for the people of Louisiana. But the movie, to me, it kind of seemed to be saying, like, if only these people had the chance to make more money, they wouldn't have to do work like this, which is not great, because sex work is real work, and there's a hint of like moralizing going on there, you know? And also like a higher minimum wage is not immediately going to solve these people's problems and suddenly have them make all the right decisions in their lives. And so that implication kind of rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I guess if you're like interested in that whole world of sugar babies, which I knew very, very little about, it certainly will open your eyes to the idea that there are a lot of men out there who will pay people for a lot of things. So yeah, that's called Sugar Babies. Tell me about Sally, Brad. What's this one?
So Sally is a documentary, and it should be coming out sometime in the near future, I think, because it's from National Geographic. It's a documentary about Sally Ride, the first female astronaut, very famous woman who was like one of the most famous people in the world for a while after she flew her first mission for NASA. And what I really loved about this documentary is how it digs into Sally Ride as a woman, both her career and personally, because so much of Sally Ride's personality and her life was pretty private. Even when she was doing so much publicity for NASA after becoming the first female astronaut ever, she was pretty private about her personal life. And this, through the eyes of the people who knew her best and people that she had relationships with, you get a much more full portrait of who she was outside of just being, you know, this woman who was made to be a poster child, essentially, for like encouraging women to do science and become astronauts and all those things. And it really is a lovely portrait of this woman who we didn't know much about, and who unfortunately had to keep much of her, you know, life hidden, because she was a lesbian woman, and she tried to keep that quiet so that it didn't disrupt anything in her career. And it wasn't until very late in her life, even right up until she passed away, that no one really for sure was aware in the public eye that she was in fact a lesbian. And so it's just it's a really interesting portrait, and it kind of doesn't paint NASA in the best light either, you know, showing how they didn't really understand how to treat Sally Ride and the other various female astronauts that were alongside her and came after her, and how the media treated her and asked her some pretty inane, stupid, sexist questions simply because she was the first woman, you know?
Yeah, that part was like, I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, when you think about the 1980s mainstream media, you probably have a baseline of like, how sexist you think they're going to be. And some of the questions in this thing, man, I just could not believe the way that they just did not take her seriously at all. Like, even her fellow astronauts, like the men that she was working alongside every single day, there are these guys who are just like, ah, I don't know, man, it was a woman, so I just didn't buy it.
Yeah.
It's just like, Jesus Christ. Like, oh, yeah. So anyway, yeah, this is really, really solid. So you enjoyed this one overall?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very good.
Excellent. Okay, so I want to talk about one called The Stringer that I really liked a lot. It's by Bao Nguyen, who directed the Bruce Lee documentary Be Water from a few years ago. So there's this image that is one of the most famous war photographs in modern history. It's this naked 9-year-old girl whose skin has been partially burned off by a napalm attack during the Vietnam War. And she's running toward the camera with a few other crying kids who are fleeing an attack. And this image was hugely important. It ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize for an Associated Press photographer named Nick Ut, who was credited with taking it and obviously experienced a great deal of fame and publicity from winning the Pulitzer. And this documentary, The Stringer, suggests that Nick Ut did not take this photo. And in fact, it was a mysterious stringer or freelancer who occasionally did work for the Associated Press at that time, who was the one who really took the photo. And this documentary is this investigation into that claim and an attempt to track down the guy who the filmmakers allege is the real author of that photo. And man, I was just so captivated by this. Like, I kind of felt like Sally maybe could have used a little bit more flair in its filmmaking, but The Stringer to me was just perfectly assembled. The cinematography is gorgeous. The production value is through the roof. And there's a sense that like you're really in the hands of a director who knows exactly what they're doing. And the story focuses on this one specific photo, but it's really about these bigger ideas of ethics and journalism and the importance of truth and stuff like that. And my understanding is that some of the claims in this doc have been refuted by the AP, the Associated Press, since the film premiered, which is not surprising considering the movie doesn't really frame the AP through a particularly great light or in a great way. But each person will come away from this with their own conclusions. And even if the truth ends up contradicting what the doc alleges, I think it's a pretty worthwhile investigation overall. So if you like journalism movies, you know, which I think at their heart are kind of all mysteries where reporters or investigators are just trying to get to the bottom of a question, I think you'll like The Stringer. And I wouldn't be surprised if this one also gets distributed by Nat Geo or a company or like that. So yeah, this one's really, really cool. So tell me about Moviabody, The Birth of House. What is this? I did not see this one.
So this is a documentary that is about the origins of house music, which started in dance clubs on the south side of Chicago. I didn't know much about this, and I'm always interested in stories that have roots in Chicago, especially when it comes to things like music that I'm not super familiar with. And so it largely focuses on where it came from, involving Vince Lawrence, who is kind of considered to be like the father of house music, and like its roots in disco music, and how there was kind of like this backlash against disco, largely from like the majority of white people, because it meant like rock was kind of facing a bit of a demise. And especially in Chicago, there was this big push, and like there's even involving this one famous DJ, Steve Dahl. And like, there's all this interesting stuff that I didn't know about it, but it's, you know, it kind of traces how the sound evolved and where it came from and how it grew, and where these various people who were part of its origin were before it started blowing up and becoming a little bit more part of mainstream music in like the early to mid 90s. And so it's really fascinating. And unfortunately, it's one of those documentaries, like many music documentaries, where you come to learn that much of the origin of house music did evolve from black culture and black people, and was eventually taken over and popularized by white people who went on to make all the money from it without these people getting a lot of the credit that they deserve, which has happened time and time again in the music industry. It's a really, really great footnote to have for every time that we talk about popular music.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
And this one is also kind of pretty formulaic, but it's propelled by a good soundtrack that uses a lot of house music, and just has really interesting conversations to have. And the other interesting thing too about house music too, if you don't know this, is that it's very much based and ingrained in gay culture as well. Like, music goes hand in hand especially in the black community, with, you know, because in the black community, people who are gay or drag queens, you know, what have you, they were kind of very much looked down upon, even more so than like in larger society. And so this like kind of gave them like music, and like in underground dance clubs, this like place that felt like their own, where they could feel safe and just like dance and like do what they wanted to do without feeling ostracized.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So it's called Moviabody, The Birth of House. Three more movies here, and then we'll wrap up this episode. There's one called The Dating Game that I saw. It's a pretty fluffy documentary about this dating coach in China who is trying to give advice to a few desperate guys who can't seem to meet women. China has this real imbalance in its population. There are 30 million more men than women there, which presumably makes it more difficult for single guys to meet up with potential partners. And the government even holds these matchmaking events throughout the country to try to alleviate the issue, but it seems to be a pretty big issue. The doc is about this guy named Hao, who is basically like I think he views himself as sort of a Chinese version of Hitch. You know, he has like 3,000 clients, and he's giving these lonely, sad, nerdy guys the pickup artist playbook, basically. And his wife is also a dating coach, and it's clear from their relationship — that's the most interesting thing in the movie to me — that their relationship, it's clear that she basically tells him straight up that the words of wisdom that he's imparting to these paying customers are actually really terrible pieces of advice that they should absolutely ignore. But there's really not much to this movie. It talks a little bit about dating apps and how people craft lies and stories to make themselves seem more interesting, but the whole doc is very thin. It's very simplistic. It's not really super enlightening, I guess. So that's The Dating Game. But there is a 1-2 punch of movies that I want to talk about to wrap this up. One of them is incredible, the other one a little less so, but they're kind of about similar topics. So a movie called Come See Me in the Good Light was directed by Ryan White. It is an incredible movie. It won the Festival Favorite Award at Sundance this year, and deservedly so, because I think it was probably my favorite thing that I saw at the entire festival, documentary or narrative feature. It's about this spoken word poet named Andrea Gibson, who might have been the first poet to play at rock clubs in America. And Andrea uses they, them pronouns. And this movie follows their relationship with their partner, Meg, and what happens when Andrea is diagnosed with cancer. And they desperately want to do at least one more big show, but Andrea's fluctuating health makes that extremely challenging. So it's a real roller coaster of emotions as they track the progress of this cancer. And the movie explores Andrea and their partner, Meg, the history of them both individually and together. And it weaves in a lot of Andrea's poetry, which is so beautiful. I'm not much of a poetry person. I don't know if you guys like enjoy poetry in your spare time or whatever, but like, man, these poems really got to me. And the whole movie is kind of this insight into a perspective shift. Like the thing I kept thinking about was like, I'm sure you get this happens to everyone where you hear about the idea of stopping and smelling the roses or living in the moment and whatever. And sort of despite my best intentions, even if I adopt that mindset for a little while, I eventually fall back into my daily routines and this sort of magic of noticing and appreciating small details in life fades into the background. But with a ticking clock on their life due to this cancer diagnosis, Andrea is able to sustain that awe and wonder in a really beautiful, emotional, and very profound way. So I love this movie. It's called Come See Me in the Good Light. And I suspect this one's going to get picked up because there was a lot of love being shared about this movie. And interestingly, there's another doc that covers very similar subject matter, but does so in a very different way. And it's called Andre is an Idiot. And this movie is about this extremely eccentric guy named Andre Ricciardi, who refused to get a colonoscopy and later discovered that he had colon cancer and a colonoscopy might have actually saved his life if he got one when he was supposed to. So in order to cope with that, Andre decides to be the subject of a documentary that will chronicle his experience living with stage four cancer and serve as both a way for him to process the fact that he is slowly dying and also provide a public service announcement to remind viewers of the importance of getting colonoscopies when you're supposed to. So Andre's friends call him a brilliant idiot. And I mean, when I say this dude is eccentric, I really mean it. He owns a pair of Kim Kardashian's pants because he wants to clone her. He talks about the Ottoman Empire with his teenage daughters instead of hugging them. He collects other people's photo albums. Like, this dude is out there. So the doc is basically him grappling with what this cancer is doing to him over the course of a few years. And despite the borderline lunatic at the center of this story, it's such a familiar thing for so many people, the idea of like dealing with a cancer diagnosis, that I think it might be valuable for people on a relatability level, even if they obviously won't relate to every bizarre thing that this guy says or does. I think there's some pretty heavy stuff in here about like the burden of the caretaker in situations like this, which doesn't really get the limelight a lot in stories about this, real life or fictionalized, and how his relationship with fear changes as his situation gets more serious, becomes like entertaining and compelling, but like also, yeah, kind of heavy. But there are also some lighter moments that I won't spoil. And the whole thing is basically about how this guy uses humor as a coping mechanism, which again, I think a lot of people can probably relate to. So yeah, that's called Andre is an Idiot. Don't make him suffer through this in vain. Get a colonoscopy if you're supposed to get one. So that's like basically one of the underlying messages of the film. So yeah, that's it for today's episode. We're going to be back tomorrow. Chris, thanks for sticking with us. I know you didn't really see as many docs here, but we're going to be back tomorrow talking about a lot of the narrative features that we all saw. And I'm pretty sure you saw a bunch of those that we can talk about. So yeah, that'll do it for today's episode. You can find more about Sundance 2025, including a handful of reviews up at slashfilm.com. I will link to them in the show notes. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See Home Club for details.